being careful, I told myself. That gives me confidence that Sarah will be safe. After that brief communication, Adam immediately wiped both email accounts from the internet. Now, here we are. We parked in front of the bus station in downtown Baltimore, the place bustling with activity even at sunset. I'm behind the wheel, Sarah in the passenger seat next to me. We fit right in, just two teenagers sitting in a crappy car in the middle of saying goodbye.
I keep waiting for the part where you try talking me out of going, Sarah says, her smile a little sad. You'll say it's too dangerous, we'll argue, you'll lose, and I'll end up going anyway.
It is dangerous, I reply, turning so I can face Sarah. And I don't want you to go.
That's more like it.
She takes my hand, lacing her fingers through mine. With my other hand, I run my fingers through her hair, eventually letting them rest gently on the back of her neck.
I pull her in a little closer.
But it's no more dangerous than staying here with me, I finish.
That's the overprotective John I know and love, she replies.
I start to protest, but cut myself off when I see her teasing smile.
These goodbyes never get any easier, do they?
I shake my head.
No, they really don't.
We fall silent, holding tight to each other, watching the minutes on the dashboard clock slowly blink away. But at the textile factory, we didn't need to have a huge discussion about Sarah going to find Mark James. Everyone seemed to agree that it was the right thing to do. If Mark really had managed to acquire some crucial information on the Mogadorians, and if he was risking his life to help us, then we needed to return the favor. But the rest of the guard was still missing, and Adam's plan to strike the Mogadorian stronghold in D.C. seemed more and more like the smartest play. A necessary strike to gather intelligence and show those bastards that we were still in this fight. There's too much happening for us to put all our resources into catching up with Mark. Sarah made it easy by volunteering. Of course, sending her off alone on a potentially dangerous mission involving an ex-boyfriend isn't exactly my favorite idea. But I can't shake the feeling that the grim future I saw in Ella's dream is racing towards us. We need all the help we can get. If there's even the tiniest possibility that sending Sarah to Alabama could help us win this war, it's a chance we have to take. My own selfish feelings be damned. And anyway, she won't be totally alone on the trip. In the back seat, Bernie Kosar stands with his paws braced against the closed window, tail wagging furiously as he watches all the people zipping in and out of the bus station. My old friend seemed pretty wiped out after the battle in Chicago, but some of his energy came back when we got on the road. Once in paradise, he'd been my protector. Now he will do the same for Sarah.
I don't want you to think of me as your girlfriend right now, Sarah says out of the blue, totally composed.
I lean back a bit, squinting at her.
That's going to be hard for me. I want you to think of me as a soldier, she persists. A soldier in this war who's doing what needs to be done. I don't know exactly what I'll find down south, but I have this weird feeling that I'll be able to help you better from there. At the very least, when it comes to battles, I won't be around to slow you down.
You don't slow me down, I insist. But Sarah waves this objection away.
It's okay, John. I want to be with you. I want to see that you're okay. I want to see you win. But not every soldier can be on the front lines, you know. Some do more good when they're away from the action. Sarah, I've got my phone, she continues,
motioning to the hastily packed backpack at her feet. Inside it, she has a disposable cell phone that Malcolm bought, along with a few changes of clothes and a handgun.
I'll check in every 8 hours, but if I don't, You have to keep going. Keep fighting.
I get what she's trying to do. Sarah doesn't want me rushing off to Alabama if she misses one of her check-in phone calls. She wants my head in the game. Maybe she can sense it, too. That we're nearing the end of this fight. Or at least crossing a point of no return. Sarah looks into my eyes. This is bigger than us, John. Bigger than us, I repeat. Knowing it's the truth. Yet wanting to fight against it. I don't want to lose her. And I don't want to say goodbye. But I have to. I look down at our interlinked hands and remember how simple things were. At least for a little while. Back when I first moved to Paradise. You know, the first time my telekinesis started working was during that Thanksgiving at your house.
You never told me that.
Sarah replies, an eyebrow raised, not sure why I'm suddenly getting sentimental.
Did my mom's cooking inspire you?
I chuckle. I don't know. Maybe. That was the same night Henri had his run-in with the original They Walk Among Us crew, along with the Mogadorians who were using them. Afterward, he wanted to leave Paradise, and I refused. Actually, I didn't just refuse. I used my telekinesis to pin him to the ceiling.
Sounds like you, Sarah says, shaking her head and smiling. Stubborn.
I told him I couldn't go back to living on the run. Not after Paradise. And you.
Oh, John.
Sarah puts her forehead against my chest. I used to think this war wasn't worth fighting if I couldn't be by your side. I tell her, gently lifting her chin. But now, after everything that's happened, after everything I've seen, I realize that I'm fighting for the future. Our future. The dashboard clock looms impossibly large in the corner of my eye. Only 5 minutes left. I focus on Sarah, wishing I had a legacy where I could freeze time or store this moment up. Tears slip down Sarah's cheeks and I wipe them away with my thumbs. She puts her hand over mine, squeezing hard, and I can tell she's trying to steel herself. She takes a deep, shuddering breath and fights back more tears.
I have to go, John.
I trust you, I whisper urgently. I don't mean just to find Mark. If things get bad, I trust you to stay alive. I trust you to come back to me in one piece. Sarah grabs the front of my shirt, pulls me in. I feel a few of her tears against my cheek. I try to let everything go. Missing my friends, the war, her leaving me, and just live for a while in her kiss. I wish I could go back to Paradise with her. Not as it is now, but the way it was months ago. Sneakily making out in my temporary bedroom, while Henri was grocery shopping, stealing looks during class. The easy, normal life. But that's over. We're not kids anymore. We're fighters. Soldiers. And we have to act the part. Sarah pulls away from me and, in one fluid motion, not wanting to drag this painful moment out any longer, she opens the door and hops out of the van. She shoulders her backpack and whistles.
Come on, Bernie Kosar.
BK clambers into the front seat, head cocked at me. As if wondering why, I'm not getting out of the van, too. I scratch behind his good ear, and he lets out a little whine. Keep her safe, I tell him telepathically. Bernie Kosar puts both his front paws on my leg and sloppily licks the side of my face. Sarah laughs.
So many goodbye kisses,
she says as BK jumps down from the van. Sarah clips on his leash. This isn't goodbye, I say.
Not really.
You're right, Sarah replies, her smile getting shaky, a note of uncertainty creeping into her voice.
I'll see you soon, John Smith. Stay safe.
See you soon. I love you, Sarah Hart.
I love you, too.
Sarah turns away, hurrying towards the sliding doors of the bus station, Bernie Kosar trotting along at her heels. She looks back at me, only once, right before she disappears through the doors, and I wave. Then she's gone, into the bus station, and eventually off to some secret location in Alabama, searching for a way to help us win this war. I have to stop myself from running after her. So I clutch the steering wheel until my knuckles are white, too white. My lumen kicks in unexpectedly, my hands glowing. I haven't lost control of that since, well, since back in paradise. I take a deep breath and calm myself down, glancing around, making sure no one outside the bus station noticed. I turn the key in the ignition, feel the van rumble to life, and pull away from the bus station. I miss her. I already miss her. I head back towards one of Baltimore's rougher neighborhoods where Sam, Malcolm, and Adam are waiting for me, planning an assault. I know where I'm going and what I'm doing, but I still feel adrift. I remember my brief scuffle with Adam in the destroyed John Hancock penthouse, how I almost fell out the window. That feeling of emptiness behind me, of teetering right next to the edge, that's how I feel now. But then I imagine Sarah's hands pulling me away from that empty space. I imagine what it will be like when we meet again. What it will be like with Cetricus Ra vanquished, and the Mogadorians beaten back into the cold emptiness of space. I imagine the future, and I smile grimly. There's only one way to make that happen. It's time to fight.
Chapter 4. We hike through the darkness, down a muddy road carved out of the swampland, the rhythmic sucking noises from our waterlogged sneakers and the incessant chirping of bugs the only sounds. We pass by a solitary wooden pole, slanted and close to being totally uprooted. The streetlight out, power lines sagging under the overgrown trees, disappearing into them. It's a welcome sign of society after 2 days spent in the swamps, hardly sleeping, turning invisible at the slightest noise, plodding our way through the muck. It was Five who led us into the swampland. He knew the way, of course. It was his ambush. We didn't have an easy time finding our way out. It's not like we could have gone back to the car we drove down here anyway. The Moogs would definitely be watching that. A few steps ahead, Nine slaps the back of his neck, squashing a mosquito. At the noise, Marina flinches, and the field of cold she's been giving off since the fight with Five momentarily intensifies. I'm not sure if Marina's having trouble getting control of her new legacy, or if she's intentionally cooling the air around us. Considering how humid the Florida swamps have been, I guess it hasn't been so bad trekking around with a portable air conditioner. You all right? I ask her quietly, not wanting Nine to overhear, and yet knowing that's impossible with his heightened hearing. She hasn't spoken to Nine since Eight was killed. Has barely said anything to me. Marina looks over at me, but in the dark I can't get a read on her. What do you think, Six? She asks. I squeeze her arm and find her skin cool to the touch. We'll get them, I tell her. I'm not much for these leader-style speeches. That's what John does, so I keep it blunt. We'll kill them all. He won't have died in vain. He shouldn't have died at all, she replies. We shouldn't have left him out there. Now they have him, doing Lord knows what to his body. We didn't have a choice, I counter, knowing it's true. After the beating we endured at the hands of Five, we were in no shape to fight off a battalion of Mogadorians backed up by one of their ships. Marina shakes her head and falls silent. You know, I used to always want Sandor to take me camping, Nine butts in out of nowhere, looking at us over his shoulder. I hated living in that cushy-ass penthouse. But man, after this, I sort of miss it. Marina and I don't respond. That's the way Nine's been talking since our battle with Five. These forced anecdotes about nothing. Weirdly upbeat, like nothing serious happened out here. When he wasn't rambling, Nine made it a habit to hike ahead of us, using his speed to put some distance between us. When we caught up, he'd have already caught some animal, usually snake, and be cooking it over a small fire he built on a rare patch of dry land. It's like he wanted to pretend we were just on some fun camping trip. I'm not squeamish. I'd eat whatever Nine caught. Marina never did, though. I don't think the roasted swamp creatures bothered her so much as the fact it was Nine doing the hunting. She must be running on empty by now. Even more so than me and Nine. After another mile, I noticed the road getting a little more packed down and well-traveled. I can see light up ahead. Soon, the non-stop buzzing of the local insect life gives way to something equally annoying. Country music. I wouldn't exactly call this place a town. I'm sure it doesn't show up on even the most detailed map. It looks more like a campground that people forgot to leave. Or maybe this is just a place where the local hunters come to bro around and escape their wives, I think, noticing an overpopulation of pickup trucks in the nearby gravel parking lot. There are a couple dozen crude huts scattered throughout this cleared stretch of swamp coast, all of them pretty much indistinguishable from an old-school outhouse. The huts basically consist of some pieces of plywood hastily nailed together, and they look like a strong breeze could knock them over. I guess when you're building at the edge of a Florida swamp, there's no point in putting too much effort in. Hung between the huts, lighting this grim little vista, are strings of blinking Christmas lights and a few gas-powered lanterns. Beyond the huts, where the solid ground sinks back into the swamp, there's a rickety dock with a few tied-up pontoon boats. The source of the music, the center of this town, and the only solid structure built here is Trapper's, a skeevy-looking bar housed in a log cabin, the name proudly displayed along the roof in sizzling green neon. A row of stuffed alligators line the bar's wooden porch, their jaws open and searching. From inside, above the music, I can hear men shouting and pool balls cracking. All right, Nine says, clapping his hands. My kind of place. The place does sort of remind me of the off-the-grid spots I used to hit up when I was alone and on the run. Places where the tight-knit and gritty locals make it easy to spot out-of-place Mogadorians. Even so, as I notice a scrawny middle-aged guy with a mullet and a tank top staring at us, chain-smoking in the shadows of the porch, I wonder if we should find a safer place for us to poke our heads in. But Nine is already halfway up the creaky wooden steps, Marina right behind him. And so I go along. Hopefully this place has a phone so we can at least get in touch with the others back in Chicago. Check to see how John and Ella are doing. Hopefully better, somehow. Especially now that we know the cure-all Five claimed to have in his chest was a bunch of crap. We have to warn the others about him. Who knows what information he might have been feeding to the Mogadorians? When we push through the swinging saloon doors of Trapper's, the music doesn't screech to a stop like in the movies, but everyone in the bar does turn their heads to stare at us, almost in unison. The place is cramped, not much to it besides than he might have been feeding to the Mogadorians. When we push through the swinging saloon doors of Trapper's, the music doesn't screech to a stop like in the movies,